How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Today, we look at news coverage of climate and environmental stories in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Emerging economies in those regions made tiny contributions to historic carbon pollution that is swirling around the atmosphere and destabilizing the Earth's operating system. But their emissions are quickly growing, and they're feeling some of the worst impacts of severe weather that is exacerbated by burning fossil fuels. Over the next hour, we'll look at the mainstream media's covering environmental and carbon stories in Brazil, China, Nigeria, and the Philippines. Joining our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, we're pleased to have with us three journalists and a media watchdog from key developing countries. Imelda Abano is president of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists in the Philippines. Gustavo Faleiros is environmental journalist and Knight Fellow from Brazil. And Litsan Liu is water director at Greenovation Hub in China. And Michael Samiri is deputy editor of the Sunday Independent in Nigeria. Please welcome them to Climate One. Welcome. Thank you for coming. I'd like to start with each of you introducing yourselves and telling us a little bit about how you came to the work you're doing. Gustavo, you worked for Valero Economico, a main business paper in Brazil, and tell us how you came into the environmental beat.
Well, this was back in 2001 when I started there. I was fresh out of the college. So I was basically doing financial journalism, and there was no many people dedicated to cover the environment. So as the junior of the newspaper, they're just saying, like, go there and do that environmental thing. And so I was, in the end, I felt very lucky because I got very passionate about the issue. So I started doing the climate coverage mainly because at that time there was a lot of the discussion about the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism coming to Brazil. But I end up dealing with the forestry issue, which is greater in Brazil. Let's say the big issue for environmental coverage is deforestation. So I end up working much more with the Amazon issue, which is my main subject nowadays.
And you founded the Amazon Communications Network. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it was a network in a sense that we felt that we needed to reach out not just journalists from Brazil, but from the other countries. The Amazon basin is shared among nine countries. So this was in a digital and environmental digital news agency. It's called OECO. So we started a project which was reaching out journalists in Guyana, Suriname, Colombia, Peru, and producing news in English, Spanish, and Portuguese to discuss how the Amazon is shared among, like, the resources are shared, the problems of deforestation, mining concessions. And most recently, we launched a new project, which is called Info Amazonia, which is more like a database of all the stories that were produced by this network of journalists.
Excellent. I'm sure we'll come back to the Amazon at some point during our conversation. Litsan Liu, you were a television reporter, and now you help educate reporters and wear lots of different hats. Tell us how you came into that.
Well, I used to be a TV reporter more than 10 years ago. But then, after several years, I joined Greenpeace as a media officer and then campaigner. So I stepped in the circle of green groups. I now work with EJN, Earth Journalism Network, as a China's coordinator for several small projects there. We train Chinese journalists. We organize the salons, workshops, field trips, etc., to help, you know, to help Chinese journalists to get more professional. Now we have some exchange field trip between China and the Southeast Asia countries for Chinese journalists. Well, it actually is a good thing to see that we have so many projects focusing on environment, especially from my perspective in China, because everyone knows that China is facing a very severe environmental problem, not only in China, but internationally. So I hope that in the future we can do more within China and with international colleagues.
Thank you. Imelda Abanyo, you won a journalism award a few years ago and then founded a journalism network. Tell us about how you did that.
Well, I covered environmental degradation in one of the 8 wonders of the world, the Ifugao Rice Terraces in the Philippines. And then I was covering health issues and women's issues that time. So I wrote about environmental, and angled it on environmental issues. And it won the IUCN Asia Reuters Media Award category. That's way back in 2002. So that started my career as an environmental journalist.
And then what prompted you to start the network?
Well, we started the network way back in 2010 with the assistance, of course, of a bigger network, which is the Internews Environmental Journalism Network. So with their assistance, we formed this, we created this Philippine network of environmental journalists, which have like more than 100 members right now. And our goal is to increase the quality and quantity of environmental reporting in the Philippines, because as you know, the Philippines, they call us like the laboratory of natural disaster. So we have the volcanic eruption, typhoons. We are visited like 20 typhoons average a year. And flooding, sea level rise, so you name it, we have it. And of course, yeah, we really have to be part of the solution. So we want to increase our tribe on environmental journalism.
We'll come back to floodings and things in the Philippines shortly. Michael Samiri, you started the Environmental News Nigeria in 2012. So tell us how you came to this beat in this profession.
Yeah, okay, I actually studied urban planning at the university. In the early 90s, I got into the Guardian newspaper. They wanted people that studied in, to be more or less specialized. So the desk was quite exciting. We had an architect, I'm an urban planner, an estate manager. We were on the desk. We gradually initiated, we started this environmental journalism in Nigeria, and it grew from there. And years later, I moved to the Punch. I still had a passion for urban planning, so I still continued studies over there. But over the years, I got involved in fellowships with the EJN, and then really
the Environmental Journalism Network,
and fellowships and training programs. I was inspired after some time to form this Environment News Nigeria. There was actually a gap there. And one of the things that started that inspired me to start this thing was I noticed that a lot of young journalists, they had nowhere to publish their stories. They had very good stories. In Nigeria, the environmental stories are not really so attractive. The municipalities want to put in the politics and the business stories there. So there was this glut of stories by young journalists. And I was also running a program for United Nations and the African Development Program to monitor young journalists. So I started this website and I got the stories. The stories were there. They actually made an impact. They were encouraged to put in the stories. And the website also turned out to be a kind of reference point for development in Nigeria. In Nigeria, we have a lot of environmental challenges. The Niger Delta area, the ocean surge in the coastal areas, the desertification in the northern areas, so many things, gully erosion in the eastern part of the country. So the website was very handy as a reference point, as an inspiration to young journalists, as a cluster, a reference point where we can get a cluster, a number of stories from Nigeria. It's actually been a challenge to me, and we've made a lot of progress in that regard.
Well, let's talk about environmental reporting broadly. In the United States, environmental reporters are a diminishing breed, and it's often thought that environmental issues are something of a luxury for people upper middle class once you have some basic needs met. So I'd like to ask all of you, and starting with Lee Tan, about where does environmental concerns rank in China right now. We've seen the headlines about people wearing masks to jog in Beijing, that sort of thing. So yeah. Give us the broad brush about environmental concerns in China, urban China.
Well, in urban China, I mean, let's take Beijing for an example. People say that Beijing is not a place for human beings to live there. You cannot exercise, you cannot run because of the bad air quality. The drinking water is a big problem. There are so many cars. We burn so many coals in North China. So, but of course, this is because one of the reasons is that there are so many middle classes now in China compared to 10 years ago. So they complain a lot about the environmental situation. But another thing is that if you look at the rural China, the problem will be worse, but people don't know. There are 300 million rural Chinese cannot access to clean drinking water. Well, it's more like the fourth, the biggest country in terms of population in the whole world. They all live in rural China, and they drink dirty water every day. The air quality should be better than it is in Beijing. But there's a lot of the so-called environmental victims in rural China because they have no power, no resources or knowledge to fight back against pollution or the consequences of climate change. So the range is pretty broad from middle class, from the top down or from the bottom up, from the rural remote areas to big cities. There are so many environmental problems now. China is kind of in a stage of pre-modern, modern, post-modern. So we are facing a lot of environmental problems you have faced or are facing now. So it's a big challenge for Chinese leaders, for our ordinary people, and for Chinese media.
And do these issues get covered in the state-controlled, government-controlled media?
Well, literally, all media should be controlled by the government. That's by law. But there are, of course, market-oriented media now in China. Generally, if you read Chinese newspaper or you watch TV, you can see many environmental coverage every day because there are so many issues happen every day. But there is, everyone knows that there is kind of a censorship. So if some real big environmental accident happened, the propaganda department will issue restriction order to media, not allowed media to cover certain issues. But generally speaking, environmental issues are not that sensitive, so we can still report a lot.
Yeah. Gustavo Filet, I'd like to ask you also whether the environmental concerns get broad coverage. Is there censorship or is there just sort of market neglect? They don't sell newspapers, so they're not in there.
No, I believe we have a good coverage in Brazil. I see newspapers, and that's, I think, a problem of the media and TV not investing so much anymore. There was a good moment in 2007 with the climate change discussion, IPCC. I think there are some studies which show that in Latin America, Brazil was one of the countries who have more coverage, like constant coverage. But besides that, we do have a good coverage right now of the development plans of the government in the Amazon, because the energy sector now in Brazil is moving to the Amazon. It's like the last frontier on energy is occupying the rivers of the Amazon. So this is so controversial because there are very large projects that you might have heard about, the Belo Monte Dam, which there's a couple of movies, James Cameron, the movie maker, went to Brazil to do the kind of a protest against the indigenous people who were being displaced or affected by the dam. So there's good coverage on these large projects. But there's one thing that it always crossed my mind, that is the Amazon, it's of course a gift to Brazil, but in terms of environmental awareness, is a curse as well. Because if you go to São Paulo, which is the hugest city in Latin America, and you ask, what is the environment for you, to any of its dwellers, they would say well, the environment is up there in the Amazon, and they don't really care about what's going on around them. So we're good on defending the Amazon, but not very good on getting engaged on solving the urban problems. I think that's the main issue right now on the coverage as well. It should have much more coverage on the urban problems, waste, water management, and pollution.
So environment means trees and endangered species rather than ecosystems and parks, urban issues, not connected directly to their lives. Yeah.
Yeah.
Imelda Abanyo, let's ask you about whether environmental issues get coverage and whether the climate is connected to some of the floods and the severe weather that the Philippines has experienced.
Yeah. You know, by the time you step out of your house, you can see, feel environmental impacts. The water not that clean, you know, we lack electricity supply in the rural areas. And the media coverage is not really as prestigious as the other bit, like the technology sector, you know, the politics, and of course show business, especially now that we have this midterm elections in May. So the coverage is improving, but the improvement's very slow.
But it's not the best career path for a journalist, is what you're saying. If you want to make it to the top as a journalist, you don't pick environment.
Right.
You pick celebrity or tech or something else. Michael Samiri, Nigeria, huge energy producer, oil exporting country. I would think that environment would be a pretty big issue there, flaring and everything else. Is that true?
It is. It's a big problem. The Niger Delta area, very notorious. A lot of pollution virtually every day. There's one spill or the other. The gas associated is flared. And we have these very active civil society organizations, and they actually carry the press along very well. And it has actually made our job very exciting. We key into the development because we have no option because it's a major disaster area in that part of the country. And we've been following it regularly, and the government has not helped matters. They keep on shifting the dates to stop the flare out. And anytime there are spills, the state-run media don't tell all the truths. So it's not led for with the private media to go down there and say the way it is, what is actually on ground.
Let's talk about climate impacts in your countries. I mean, some of the developing countries have experienced some of the most severe climate impacts, and perhaps we can start with Imelda. You know, floods in the Philippines, pretty epic floods. You're getting a lot of unwanted water, at least not in the times that you're used to getting it. So tell us about the climate impacts and floods.
Well, Last year, while we have this United Nations Climate Change Conference, we were like submerged by a lot of flooding, and then the policymakers or the government doesn't care about us anymore because we are literally sinking, you know? And of course, the other small islands also. And it's really, really disgusting for us journalists to be covering environmental issues if the government itself doesn't care about it.
So there's floods and they're not responding or providing aid to victims of the floods.
Right. But right now, well, the government at least is concentrating on implementing laws on urban planning at least.
Lee-Tan, let's ask you. There's also been floods in China. We've talked a little bit about the air pollution. What other climate impacts is China wrestling with?
The media coverage on climate change is not really good in China, especially after 2009, after the Copenhagen conference. But when there is extreme weather event happened, people tend to say that it is because of climate change. Even my mother, sometimes if the winter is too cold or too warm, she will say that, climate is changing. But, I mean, that's about ordinary life. But usually, because China is a country where a lot of floods happen every day and the drought happen every year, not every day. So people tend to think it's a natural thing. We don't really think it is highly related related to climate change, so it's hard to tell people that climate change is is just there.
Are there hardcore climate change deniers like there are in Washington, D.C.? I mean, they're a special breed.
Yeah, I believe so. But maybe not in the government, but no, ordinary people. They just don't. They think it's too far away thing. I mean, it's not a urgent thing.
So it's the opposite of here, Gustavo. Are there climate change deniers who think it's a conspiracy or made up?
Well, there are some, but I think in Brazil they are not so strong. I mean, like it was even a subject of a study by the Reuters Institute of Journalism in Oxford. They tried to map skeptics in developing countries, and it seems that Brazil has not very loud ones. We have very good scientists on climate issue, and that's why I think they're getting much more attention. And these scientists are specifically showing the impacts of climate on the Amazon, on the which might have heard about the savannization of the Amazon becoming a savanna, much more dry than the conditions which allows to be a rainforest. So the fact is, in 10 years, we had two droughts that never happened in 50 years before. It was 2005 and 2010. And they're saying it's going to happen this year again. So if it happens this year again, it means like you have three record droughts in less than 10 years, which used to happen in a historical pattern. So there's a lot of attention on this thing. Same thing with floods or landslides, mudslides on the coast of Rio. The coast of Rio is known by being very beautiful because it's very dramatic, but it's very steepy, and a lot of people living there, maybe they should. But the fact is, like, there's historical rains creating a lot of deaths, and there was 1,800 people dead 2 years ago because of a major rain, which also was considered historic. So.
But on the Amazon, some people think the Amazon is a relatively positive story, that it's at risk, but Brazil has done a fairly good job, I'd like to hear your view, on addressing the risks and slowing the incursion of farmland and cattle grazing, that sort of thing, that it's at least a somewhat positive story of recognizing the risk and managing it. Is that accurate?
It's true. It's true that there was a major improvement on combating deforestation, and for the last 6 years, the deforestation was literally cut by half, and this is happening in Brazil, but I don't think this should put people in a glorious mood, because there is a lot of things happening linked to Brazil, which is, for example, roads that are being built to connect Brazil to Peru, driving much more gold mining. There's another problem, which is we are discussing now, is it possible to get a net zero deforestation, which means like you have allow some areas to regrow and you still have some kind of legal deforestation, because as you might have heard, many parts of the Amazon doesn't have a very good soil, so you need to burn some, or you need to cut some trees to keep the production going on, so you need to have some legal deforestation. But is it possible to have a zero net deforestation? We're kind of far from this. So we have a lot of small deforestation going on. You don't have more like these large things that you would say in the 80s, in the 90s, like those images that were shocking the world. But you still have like very small patches being destroyed every day. And how do you deal with this? These small farmers that don't have any technical support. So it's a big challenge yet.
So the pace of destruction is slowing but not stopped. If you're joining us on the radio, Gustavo Faleiros is an environmental journalist and night fellow from Brazil. Our other guests at Climate One today are Imelda Abanyo, president of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists. Litsan Leo is water director at the Green Innovation Hub in China. And Michael Samiri is deputy editor of the Sunday Independent in Nigeria. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk a little bit about the food, energy, and food water tension, because that can be a big environmental issue as middle classes emerge. There's a desire for animal protein diets, and that can create both water stress and environmental stress. So who would like to address that in some of your coverage? Michael, I know that the farmers in Nigeria, that's a big issue for them, wrestling with water scarcity already.
Yeah, and the climate variation. Climate change is making things very worse, and they are faced with the challenge of how to adjust their planting seasons and things like that. And the media has been up of you know, of help in recent years, and most of my reports have actually focused on adaptation and
Dealing with the impacts of climate change.
Impacts of climate change for so that they can make changes and know what to do, how to adjust, you know, and to still be relevant in their work.
And Emilio Banos, let's ask you how the food tension is playing out in the Philippines with severe weather and climate impacts.
Yeah, I have interviewed a lot of farmers already, and they don't know about climate change. But they do know that the cycle of farming is it's very different now compared before. So I think the impact there is that the food supply is getting scarce. With, like, for example, in the Philippines only, we have like more than 95 million population. It's really hard for them to produce more with this kind of extreme and erratic weather.
Is that affecting food prices?
Yes, of course.
So, and is that affecting political stability? Maybe we can get Lee Tsan. I mean, there's concern about rising food prices, instability in China. That's got to be something on the leadership's mind.
I'm sorry, what?
Rising food prices related to weather, severe weather, food supply, and political stability.
Yeah, you know what? We import a lot of corns or soybeans from the States. So, because it is cheaper than produce it in China. And we buy a lot of land in Africa now to develop agriculture. We we have to grow rice there. We raise poultry, pigs, cows there to make milk, to make meat. But the thing is that it is the food shortage is not a big issue or not a big concern for many Chinese. Instead, it is the food safety. It's so unsafe that we want to buy everything abroad if we have chance. So it's really a it caused a problem in Hong Kong and in some other countries right now because of the infant milk and powder, something like that.
Deliberately tainted with chemicals, right?
Yeah. We just scared because of the food safety issue, because of the pollution, something.
And in Hong Kong and Beijing, you start to see a little bit of organic food developing and some kind of awareness of the connection about getting things closer, things that are sort of good for the personal health as well as environmental health. Let's talk about that. Is that something that's obviously, it's a premium in the United States that are considered a luxury by many people. What's it like in a developing country like China or Brazil or the others?
Well, it's still luxury. I mean, only in upper middle class can afford the price of those organic foods. No, it's not for everybody in China. It's still developing. More and more middle class in China now are seeking those kind of foods around their cities. But we cannot just find so many good soil for them because many percentage of the soil have been contaminated. So it's very hard for many ordinary Chinese to get those safe food.
And the idea of eating imported refrigerated produce in China that comes from California, that's not so good from a climate perspective, carbon perspective. Gustavo, let's get you in on Brazil and the organic food, whether that's part of the emerging awareness.
Yeah, it's a part of, it's a big trend in Rio or in São Paulo. And I think it's going to be more and more because I think it's going to be a local production, because you have to remember that Brazil is one of the countries which is more linked to the world trade of food. So sometimes your sugar just double the price and you don't know why, and it's just because they decided to import more sugar than sell inside of the country. And this applies for many things like meat, because then the soybean price went up, and so and it affects the whole market. So I've been experienced myself in São Paulo, that's getting much more affordable to buy organic food or local production than going to a major supermarket chain.
You mentioned sugar. Obviously, a lot of people associate sugar with ethanol in Brazil, and actually people can actually dial, I believe, at the pumps. Yeah. You can actually blend your fuel in terms of how much ethanol, how much gasoline. But you have some concerns about that the biofuels have softened recently because of electric vehicles. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's the main thing. I mean, nobody could imagine when President George W. Bush went to Brazil in 2008 that the ethanol in Brazil would suffer such a backdrop. I mean, like, it's not happening the way people were imagining. We were imagining that we would be supplying, exporting ethanol all over the world, and just not happening. Even the supplying side is going down. And it's surprising because they started producing these cars in large quantities. Most of the cars now that are sold in Brazil are double fuel, but the supply of ethanol is just not reliable because the price of sugar is high. So the mill who does ethanol does sugar as well. So it's better to sell sugar than sell ethanol. So it's a complicated issue. The current government has to be blamed by what I've seen, because they've been controlling the price of gasoline, so the gasoline is cheaper as well than buying ethanol in like comparable terms, like the efficiency for the car in terms of economics. So nobody would imagine that a sector like the ethanol sector would suffer such a backstep so soon.
So the government, if I heard you correctly, is keeping the price of gasoline low but allowing the price of sugar to go up.
Yeah, well, the price of sugar is market price, and the gasoline price is controlled by Petrobras, which is the state-owned
monopoly
oil company.
Yeah, yeah.
And the government to control the inflation, because inflation is the major political issue in Brazil, and it might have seen now that we're almost there, almost not big inflation as in the 80s, but almost getting these tensions that is going to hinder the political power. So inflation is the thing, and government tends to control gasoline to control inflation. So once you control gasoline, you're allowing people to buy more gasoline, which creates more pollution and hinders the ethanol sector. It's just crazy.
Gustavo Faleiros is an environmental journalist from Brazil. Litsan Leo, let's get you on the price of gasoline in China. Is that something also the government keeps low for political stability, which facilitates a family car for the burgeoning Chinese middle class?
What? I don't think the price of gasoline in China is low compared to it is in America.
Well, that's in our constitution.
Well, it is controlled by the government, but the price is more market because it compares to the price in Europe and in America and in other countries. It's pretty much not that high and not that low, so it's okay. But middle class always complain about the rise of the price because it just rise, you know, step by step, gradually, in recent years. But people seem have no choice. They should buy a car because they don't want to, you know, to be squeezed in the bus or in the subway. They can't afford the gasoline, so it's not. People tend not to think it's a problem of climate change or pollution. People just think it's something that we have to do, we have to buy, and we have to afford.
And this gets to a key issue of equity between developed countries and developing countries. Gustavo, you believe that, you know, or anyone else, that the people in emerging countries have an equal right to the kind of development and lifestyle that people here in the West enjoy, and that they can't and shouldn't be denied that. It's actually a moral issue.
Yeah, no. The right of developing, it's not in question. I mean, everybody wants to have a nice life, and I think we're getting there, and it's really interesting to see how the country has. I was born in the 70s. I'm getting old, I might say. So I lived the 80s with the hyperinflation time. It was totally different. Like, it's a much better country now. There's no doubt about it. But it can be done different. So what makes me sad is seeing sometimes that the political discussion doesn't get to the point of an alternative development. I'm not saying that we should stay living in huts, nothing like that. I'm just saying, like, it has to be a way, a different way. And we are the ones who have to propose this. Brazil, more than any other country, because the Amazon is the largest place, the rainforest in the world, the biodiversity and everything, we have to propose something alternative. So it's not that we don't want to develop, or I propose no development, but it has to be done in a different way.
Imelda Albano, you have covered the UN climate negotiations and this issue of sort of clean development and technology and money transfers to developing countries is a big issue in those climate talks. Let's have your thoughts on sort of this equity issue about developing countries' right to have equal access to develop cleanly.
Right. The developing countries are asking for a technology transfer to the developed countries. And I think it's the responsibility of the developed countries to, of course, share their knowledge and share some technology to the poorer countries so they can also move on and rise.
As well as financial transfers. But American taxpayers aren't too willing to send money overseas for that kind of stuff. And no individual company says, well, they're going to take money out of their pocket to do that. That's the tough part.
Right. I don't blame the big companies or the corporations or the non-profit organizations. But yes, it's really a tough question and a tough topic for us also.
Michael, any thoughts on that? I mean, a lot of the pollution that's destabilizing the continent, I've had people here who said it's red, white, and blue, which means it's American and Russian and French. But let's hear your thoughts on that equity issue. In terms of developed countries created the problem, and now there's a tough block for a developing nation.
Yeah, I think developed nations need to take responsibility to address this issue. Nevertheless, I think developing nations too should not just sit back and expect money to come. They need to find a way of generating money to address these issues locally. What if the developed nations have their own issues as well? You can't depend on that fully. And it reminds me of a topic in Nigeria concerning the clean development mechanism. The school of thought has it that, in fact, it's very ongoing now that one of the areas that Nigeria is trying to sell in the CDM, that's the clean development mechanism, is to...
Which we should say that's a United Nations program for funding for projects.
Funding projects. And we add this a project whereby we're trying to curb gas flaring. So one of the projects is to now curb the flaring and use the gas captured to generate some power to local communities. But a particular group are saying that ordinarily Nigeria should have stopped this flaring long ago. Why are you now using this CDM issue to address this issue? You're trying to make money from what you have done before. So it's very controversial in Nigeria, all these issues. So
If you're just joining us, Michael Samiri is deputy editor of the Sunday Independent in Nigeria. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about clean technology, and then in a few minutes we're going to bring in our audience. But let's talk about the flip side of this. We've been talking a lot about brown energy and the other impacts. Mm-hmm. Clean technology, renewable technologies, there's some promise. Certainly, we talked a little bit about biofuels in Brazil. Litsan, often people think that China has a big lead on batteries and solar industry. So, but there's been some bumps lately. But tell us about your coverage or your thoughts on clean tech in China, which...
Well, if you ever heard that the biggest Chinese solar energy company just bankrupt. So
SunTech was went bankrupt.
So yeah, people think that it may signal that how tough the clean technology market is. We produce a lot of so-called clean technology products, but we use only some of them, and we export a really large part of the products to Europe or United States, maybe. So I don't think, China is trying to do more in terms of renewable technology or energy development, but the thing that China is still lag behind in terms of science, technology, and other stuff. So It is a big challenge for business persons in China and for Chinese leaders to, you know, to really, you know, to do what they want to do in terms of clean technology.
Imelda Abano, is there a clean tech sector in the Philippines?
Yeah, but we have not reached that clean technology boom yet, because first of all, we are concentrated on poverty issues, putting food first into the mouths of the people there, then buying very expensive solar panels like that. But we are improving. We have these small hydro projects, wind energy projects also.
Michael Samiri, does any money from oil exports go to clean energy in Nigeria?
Yeah, we are looking at it because we have a lot of energy challenges, pollution, trying to control the pollution from the energy. And there's a lot of projects going on, proposal stage at different stages. We're trying to harness the solar energy, the Sahara Desert, and several have been brought up to harness this potential, and we are really looking at several proposals in Nigeria.
We're talking about news coverage of environmental and climate issues in Brazil, Philippines, Nigeria, and China. You're listening to Climate One. Let's talk about population. People look at the growth of population to 9 billion, and a lot of environmentalists don't like to talk about population, but that's one of the biggest levers driving increased consumption, resource extraction, stress overshoots. There's lots of words for these things. Is that part of the environmental conversation? I mean, China got population under control through some very strong measures. That has its own set of issues. But Li Chan Liu, let's talk about, is population connected at all to the environmental stress issues?
Of course. I mean, if you divide those problems with population, you can see that the average thing of environmental problems is not that big, but if you put it together, it's a really big thing in China, and it will affect other countries. But the thing that now within China, we're discussing, you know, whether we should end the one-child policy now, not because of environmental concerns, but because we think that we have, you know, to make this policy for more than two decades, so the China is getting older before it gets richer. So it may be a time to for a discussion of the end of this policy, but it's still in the air somewhere. People tend not to think a lot about population and with environmental issues, but of course it is highly related to population.
So a lot of the models of 9 billion people, that could change if China changes the one-child policy, that 9 could become, that could have some real serious impacts of that. Let's invite your participation. We'll put the microphone here. If you're on this side of the audience, please go back through that door. The line begins with our producer, Jane Ann, there. And we invite you to join us for one part, comment or question. And we'll get you in here, part of the conversation. Let's go to audience questions. Welcome to Climate One. Yes, sir.
All right. My name is David Akana. I have a question to all the panelists. Would you just want to share your thoughts a little bit with respect to the challenges that you have covering all these sets of issues that you have talked about? And the world is right now at a critical junction whereby in the next 2 years we're going to be switching from the MDGs probably to the Sustainable Development Goals. What is it that the media needs to do to be able to up its game and be able to participate in making sure that it's actually playing its watchdog role as we move on to post-2015? Thank you.
MDG, the Millennium Development Goals. Who'd like to tell? Michael?
I think the media should focus not only on the problems, but also be find a way of part of the solution. I think that is vital. In this regard, that's my contribution.
Gustavo, what else?
I think one of the challenges of this coverage is that these are longer term commitments or longer term result or impacts. So it's very difficult to actually create a momentum in a newspaper or with your editor or with your audience that these subjects are actually important. So and tell the story of something that's going to be reached in 50 years. And so that's, I see one of the main challenges, really, to tell a good story with such a kind of a vague target sometimes.
And there are a lot of process stories. The UN process, it's complicated. It's a lot of how, and it's really tough to make those compelling stories. Let's have our next audience question. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you all for coming and sharing your opinions and insights with us tonight. I wanted to know, in terms of international negotiations, we've always seen that cultural differences about how the climate is conceived play a major role in how different countries interact with the climate issue and end up having conversations about it. In the U.S., for example, we know that it's tightly linked to, is this an economic burden or such? What I wanted to know is, for limiting those sorts of misunderstandings, what would you think internationally is the least recognized cultural or conceptual framework of the climate issue in your countries that the rest of the world doesn't conceive of? Is it rural issues? Is it something to do with a particular subsection of the environment, like in the Amazon? How does the climate get framed in your countries that the rest of the world doesn't recognize as part of your leaders' calculus?
So how is the climate framed in your country that might be different than somewhere else? Gustavo Fuller?
Yeah, I would say that it's mainly that the issue that you can have a big region in the country just drying out. And I don't think people might understand what does it mean. And I tell you how this would affect, and it's not just because you would lose immense biodiversity, but you end up changing the whole climate system of the region, maybe of the world. And there was just one specific example here, which was very funny. A few years ago, there was a major drought in Argentina. And so soybean production, corn production, really, really bad. And one day, the Clarín newspapers puts big headlines. It's like, it's Brazil's fault. It was like, and it was a great story. It was just explaining the science behind the rains of the region, which is like you have a blow coming from the Atlantic, pushing the moisture from the Amazon into the Andes, which comes down to the Argentina and rains in that region. So because of deforestation, these rains are diminishing. So I think that's something that is not being totally understood.
Michael Samiri, you also have thoughts about resource conflicts and wars that are climate related in Africa.
Yeah, it's a very topical issue in Nigeria now. We have this popular lake within the Sahara, it's called Lake Chad. It's actually shared by about four countries: Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, Mali, several countries are. Over the years, the lake has really shrunk considerably, attributed to climate change and several issues. And a lot of people depend on this lake, and the agriculturalists, the pastoralists, and all that. And of recent, there was a discussion of recent that linked these developments to terrorism. We have this big problem in Nigeria now called Boko Haram. It's a group that is against the Western education and bombing and all those things. So there was a research, they found out that, to a large extent, a lot of youths that were engaged, they were living was tied to the lake, had become very idle, and were now susceptible to, influences by this group. And there's also another scenario. A lot of these pastoralists, these nomadic that they move around, They don't stay anywhere. They take along the cattle that where they go, and the rivers are shrinking. The grazing grounds are disappearing. So they now move closer to farmlands, and they can be very aggressive when they are resisted. Resist their cattle from feeding. So this is a major area that is affecting climate. We are tying climate change with development, agriculture, and all that. It's a big problem.
There's a movie out there called Climate Refugees. There's also a book out there called Climate Wars, if you'd like to look into more of either of those. Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Yes, this is a question regarding China and Africa. There's a significant amount of poaching going on in Africa for horns from rhinoceros and elephant to go to markets in China and Vietnam. What role has the Chinese media played in helping to expose this problem and potentially combat it?
I don't see much coverage on China's investment in effort on Chinese media actually, but it is becoming more. But still, know, lacking of resources or sources for news, Chinese media cannot to cover such stories because it's not that. I mean, suppose that there's a story about China's investment or its relationship with Africa, its audience does not care too much. So it's very hard for Chinese media to report a lot about the China-Africa market issues.
Let's have our next audience question. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just wondering, kind of from all of you, what makes the most compelling environmental story that you've told? So maybe you could each give an example of the story that you've told that you were surprised by how much attention it got. And, you know, what makes the most compelling story to people that feel disconnectedly, like you're saying, from environmental issues?
Great question. So impact, your favorite story. Gustavo Federos, then we'll go down.
Yeah, well, I have one specific story which it relates with one specific species, with very conservation stories. We have this Spix macaw in Brazil. Do you know the movie Rio? That macaw is a Spix macaw, but the Rio just placed it in the totally wrong place. She never lived in Rio. I say she because we use it, a woman's name for it, but she lives in the dry shrub area of Brazil, but is extinct in nature because of traffic. But now there is a lot of effort to bring it back, and this effort is done by the sheikh in Qatar. So I went to Qatar to see where this guy, just because what people think, but I'm not saying this, is that the guy actually had bought the birds for fun many years ago, but because of the CITES, which is the law for not trafficking animals, he started breeding the birds, and now it's the most successful breeding all around the world, and I think he has almost 100 birds. And he committed himself to bring the birds back to Brazil, and he bought a whole area of the land to put the birds back. And so when I found out this story, I was like, that's an amazing story, and I told, and I got so many responses of people. Some saying, like, it's beautiful that we might have this species back in the wild, but some saying, like, what's this crazy sheikh wants with us? And some, why he has all of our birds? And so it was an amazing response.
Lisan Leo, a story with impact.
I have a story about one of the EJM fellows several years ago. He went to a city in middle China, where there are many polluting companies there. But the deputy mayor told him that there's no any pollution around this area. But of course, he found the truth and he reported. Right after he reported the pollution there in the city, the deputy mayor was fired. You can see the immediate effect, you know, from media coverage, even in China. It's you can find many good stories every month in China about environmental issues. Believe me, China is now at the gold mine of environmental stories. It is a lot every day, you can see.
And there's actual a lot of protests and civil disobedience. You can't protest, but you can walk around places, right?
Yeah. Legally, we cannot demonstrate. We can by constitution, but we cannot, actually. So... yeah. So the urban middle class invented a walk around the building, walk around the government building, something like that. We wear masks to complain about air quality. So it's okay. I mean, the police is also breathing the air, so they will not do something about it. So it's okay to do something like that. So the media, if there's no restriction order from the propaganda department yet, the media tend to cover those kind of protests as soon as possible. So you can see those protests, environmental protests, in many parts of China in recent years, especially in urban areas. There are a lot.
Imelda Abanio, a story that had impact that's really memorable for you.
I remember in 2009, I did a story about a fisherman. I was in a holiday, actually. So, I was walking along the beach. I saw those fishermen coming to the shore, and they catch nothing but a little fish like this. little fishes. So I just asked them, just curiosity. And then I did a story on the impacts of not getting much catch. And then actually the story was linked on environmental issues and climate change like that. So the story actually won me as an Asian Journalist of the Year. And then the impact of that is that the local government created a job for the fishermen and, of course, their wives for some livelihood in the community.
So they're no longer fishermen, but they're okay. Michael Samiri?
Okay, I remember this story. I don't know if I'll call it an impact, but it's very memorable, very interesting. We had this, would I call it a drought, for some time in Lagos, Nigeria. There was no rain for quite some time. And somebody told me about a farming community outside of Lagos. I went there. I spoke to this set of farmers. They told me their challenges. There's no how they've planted. The ones they've planted, they've not been able to. It's not growing. The plantings, they can't plant again because the rains have not come. Very good article. I was about to write the article. A few days later, then this heavy rain came to Lagos. It rained all day. All through the day, it flowed, and it just occurred to me, why don't you go back to this family community? I went there. The story was another extreme story entirely. The person that said there's no water, it was flooded because it was forced to move to a swampy land because when there was rather drought because there was no now everywhere was flooded. It lost everything. So I got. Oh, there's another woman, a single mother. She put all her life savings into this project called Job for Rights Program by the Lagos State Government. There was no rain. She lost over 300,000 naira from all her investments went. Then that same rain, I went to her. She had gotten a residence somewhere. The rain came and there was a serious mudslide that virtually covered her house. So now I sat down and wrote this. I call this story coping with two extremes. The first scenario when there was no rain, and the second when there was too much rain. It turned out to be a very interesting article.
And telling of the kind of extremes we're going to see with too much and too little, and the same measures, similar measures. Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Hi, thank you all for this discussion. As you all are probably aware, in the United States, the fossil fuel industry is very politically powerful and has had a huge influence on policy in the United States, most of which has not been very good. I was wondering, especially for Nigeria and Brazil, how has your country interacted with the multinational oil companies? I know Brazil, there was just some big incident with an international company over a spill and whatnot. And Nigeria, I'm assuming a lot of your oil is being drilled by international companies. I was wondering, how do they influence your politics and your economy and your countries?
I think they're getting more and more influence. The episode that you mentioned, it was the oil spill of Chevron, which was the largest oil spill we had so far in Brazil. And I think it harmed a little bit the reputation of international companies which are just getting to Brazil right now. Well, they're there for long, but getting in big time for the underwater, the offshore exploitation. But not enough. So there's a lot going on. Actually, we have to see what is coming because it's a very, very unique operation. We're talking about exploiting oil 7 kilometers down the earth. Like after you reach the seabed, still you go more 7 kilometers, and this is 200 kilometers from the coast. So you're creating a whole new operation. It's not helicopters, but because helicopters cannot fly 200 kilometers, so we're creating these bases of where they're going to fly helicopters and taking boats. So you see how much room for something going on wrong exists on this operation. So, and this cannot be done without international companies. Petrobras, the company, cannot do it by themselves. So they're partnering with BP, Chevron, all the big guys for doing this. So let's see.
Michael Samiri.
So they are very vital in Nigerian economy. It basically depends on oil, crude oil, petroleum, and the big oil firms are there, of course, Shell, Chevron. of course, they shape the policies. The government needs them to get out this crude oil. But the downside of it is the pollution issue. There's a lot of spillage. They're still flaring a lot of gas. That is just the downside of it. And we're not still refining the crude oil. We take it out of the country and bring it back, and it's now very expensive petrol. So that's the issue. It's vital for the Nigerian economy, but there's a lot of pollution going on.
Are you saying you'd rather have it refined in the country? Because that would be dirtier refineries in your country.
Well, it would be cheaper, and politics and whatever is not making the refineries to work somehow.
Let's have our last audience question. Welcome.
I'm actually just following up on that question. You all live in countries where oil companies, foreign oil companies, produce oil and natural gas or have operations. And I'm actually curious as to the impact of foreign oil corporations potentially on your reporting. Do you face challenges in trying to report on those companies and their activities?
I am. I have a good example. I talked about the CDM projects earlier.
Clean development mechanism project earlier.
One or two oil companies are involved in one of them to gas capture, and the gas that was usually flared will now be captured and used to generate some power to local communities. Some time ago, we decided that, okay, let us see what is happening, because they are officially they are approved by the UNFCCC, that's UN
Climate Change Convention.
We said, let's go and look at what's really happening. Officially, they are approved CDM projects. Are they really doing these things? We sent several letters of request. We never got any. We sent them last year. Up to today, we've not gotten. We made several moves. We've not really made any impact. That is a very good example of how they're not being cooperative.
Other examples of sort of pressure on news coverage?
Well,
I'm going to ask the other, anyone else? Litzan or Gustavo?
No, not personally. I think that the Chevron episode in Brazil, it was quite complicated. There's actually a court trial now, which includes an accusation against Chevron that they have omit information. They actually lied in the very beginning about the extension of the oil spill. So that's the kind of information that I'm talking about, like the right of information in general, not just in journalism. So, but I personally never had any problem.
Well,
Litan Liu.
Yeah, sure. In China, because we have three, the giant oil companies, they are totally controlled by the government. So, you can report a small accident or spillover or those accidents from Chevron or other foreign companies. But for these three companies, you will feel pressure from the government. It's not easy for the media to cover those spillover accidents from them. But still, the Chinese media are struggling to covering more situation from these three companies. So we complain a lot. We criticize those companies. But still, it's not easy. It's a challenge.
We have to end it there. Our thanks to our guest today. Litzan Liu is a water director at the Green Innovation Hub in China. Michael Samiri is deputy editor of the Sunday Independent in Nigeria. And Gustavo Faleros is environmental journalist and Knight Fellow from Brazil. And Imelda Albano is president of the Philippine Network of Environmental Journalists. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you for listening and coming to Climate One today.